Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I always tell my guests that the show kind of flies by, because we're going to be tackling a lot of subject matter, but I do have a guest with me for the whole show, because it's not commercial radio, an hour. Well, you know, there are certain morning shows you get, or certain radio shows, you get 2 to 5 minutes if you're lucky.
And and TV's worse. Yeah.
Right. So we're long form. We're an album cut here at Film Sociology.
That's great.
And joining me in studio is, well, we can say now author Jeffrey Sparks, who is the author of Changing Culture Through Stories. He's also kind of best known as the guy who created New Harmony Project in the Heartland Film Festival. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Matthew.
Good to have you here.
Yeah, great to be with you.
I have to say, full disclosure, this man, when I was starting out in this market, this man introduced me to a few people and kind of helped me get seen. So I never forget that, and I appreciate that.
You're welcome. You've done a great job in the film world, in the jazz world. You're beloved in this city for those things, and you're great hugs.
Thank you. Thank you. Just clawing my way to the middle.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a lot of material we need to cover, but first I want to say we are in grown-up movie season, you know. We have films of note and documentaries, and the one I got to see this week that opened, and it's the documentary Maria by Callas about famed opera singer Maria Callas. And kudos to Tom Vorf for directing this, because it is, for the most part, it is interview archives with her, performances of her, of course, in the 50s and 60s, and then a few of her diary entries and letters that are read, in this case, by...
They're read.
Allison Janney. Sorry, that's...
Okay.
Coffee is good.
Yeah.
But so this is one of those, I think, for me, I'm not the biggest opera fan in the world. I should have Stephen Solon on to talk about that, because it's serious music. But it does give you a insight. And if, for a documentary, and I think certain documentaries, if you don't know anything about it and you learn something, mission accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
And if it makes you want to go and seek out information about it, whether to prove the film right or wrong, I say mission accomplished.
Yeah.
I always use the example. There was a documentary over a decade ago called The U.S. versus John Lennon. And it was about the U.S. government, Nixon, and his attempts to deport John Lennon in the early 70s. I knew this. And so the basis of it is this is probably not made for me. It's for a younger crowd who didn't know this was going on. So in the case of this, I knew that the opera world is tough. Let's never forget that. And I know the term diva is thrown around too much. And the fact that its origins begin with this genre of music. And if you've ever seen an opera company, you know there are performances on Fridays and then Sundays. And that's for a reason. So just, you know, it's a rough business. And so for her to get into the business, and you hear stories of her clashing with composers, with artistic directors, of her not wanting to do opera's greatest hits. And if it means doing lesser known operas in Dallas in the mid 50s or late early 60s, then so be it. So it was really insightful, and I'm glad I got to see it. And so if you're a fan of music as a whole, it's out there. So go check out Maria by Callas.
Yeah, I love documentaries. I always think at Heartland, often the strongest films are the documentaries that we get.
And I mean, with the film festival, you also got to see in the history of the festival in a rise in documentaries. Getting, you know, as a kid, for me, it was you went to a college campus and maybe the art house cinema in the Detroit suburbs or indie suburbs, and that was it. And so, when you had documentaries by Errol Morris and Michael Moore and Werner Herzog, and they're opening 500,000, 2,000 screens. I mean, I would have never guessed that when I was younger.
No, not at all.
Do you remember the first documentary that piqued your interest?
Oh, wow. There's a good one. When I hear great documentaries, there's ones that come to mind. I don't know the first one. Would have been in high school probably. I remember something on JFK because I was actually sick when he was shot home. I was in the doctor's office when we found out, and I got to spend the next few days at home. A lot of people don't realize that Ruby shot
Oswald,
thank you, Sunday morning when most people in Indianapolis, a lot of people were in church, but I wasn't. I was home sick. So I got to see that happen. I was watching everything.
I say, was it interrupted programming when Ruby got shot?
No, were watching him being transported.
It was on.
Yeah, it was.
Okay.
It was on, watching him being transported and saw him shot.
And Kennedy was shot on a Friday?
Probably.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Probably. Wow. And that's so hard to top TV after that.
Yeah. But I remember watching a documentary, about the shooting and Were There More, the Grassy Knoll, all that. That's probably the first documentary I remember.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So anyway, that is in theaters, Maria by Callas. Going to DVD and Blu-ray quickly, Criterion, always putting out stuff of various notes. They have put out their own version of Orson Welles's The Magnificent Ambersons.
Mm. Interesting Indiana connection.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm hoping next week I will be able to talk to you folks about the Orson Welles film that has finally been released on Netflix with, of course, John Huston and Peter Bogdanovich and he. Also on Criterion, the Talking Heads film True Stories from the 80s.
Yep.
If you're into this sort of thing on Blu-ray, and the thing about the Blu-ray titles is, Is it a new release or are they just repackaging it? Because sometimes you're like, wait a minute, didn't I talk about this last year? But if you need the 1974 musical MAME with Lucille Ball, not Angela Lansbury, that is out there. And Lucio Fulci's Zombie from 1979 is also on Blu-ray. So
the Magnificent Ambersons, there's two Indiana ties there.
Please.
The first one is obvious.
Mm-hmm.
It was written by Tarkington, who... It's about Indianapolis, though I don't think it's been a long time. But do you know who edited that?
Would that be Robert Wise?
Yes.
Of course, who edited Citizen Kane and then went on to have a pretty good directing career himself.
But it was controversial because they took Orson Welles off the project and had Bob go back in and re-edit it, and he and Orson didn't get along too well after that.
And that's this is one of the great what could have beens, I think. Yeah. I mean, he was able to, well, people were able to restore Touch of Evil to a certain degree, but Amberson's is, it's not, it's, we're never going to see what Orson wanted
no,
made.
No.
So, and that being said, it's still heralded. Some people say it's even better than Kane.
Yeah.
So
it's a wonderful, wonderful film.
Yep. So that is out there. I want to mention a couple things at the Historic Art Craft Theater. If you're listening to this on Saturday, you have a chance to see this Saturday night and tomorrow at Sunday at 2 p.m. because I think it's better to see that, even though I'm not a fan of the film, seeing this on the big screen is still better than it being for on TNT for 24 hours. A Christmas Story, because it's December, you know. I still like Darren McGavin married to Melinda Dillon. Way to go, Knight Kolchak. December 7th, 8th, and 9th. Friday and Saturday at 2 and 7.30 p.m. and Sunday at 2 p.m. Of course, another one on the big screen. You can see it on TV, but go see it on the big screen. It's A Wonderful Life.
Great, great film.
And I should mention, this weekend and next weekend, there is a radio version of It's a Wonderful Life that's being done at the University of Indianapolis as well as the Actors Theater up in Carmel. And I believe the Carmel one is running through the end of the month. I don't have that in front of me. But anyway, go check those. I've had the honor of directing this. It's a 40s radio play with, you know, for our production, it was one actor playing George, one lady playing Mary, and then two gentlemen and a lady playing all the other roles.
Right.
Sound effects table, music, built-in commercials, a lot of fun. So anyway, that is happening there at the Art Craft on December 14th, 15th, and 16th, 2 and 7.30 p.m. Friday and Saturdays, 2 and 5.30 p.m., I guess you need to see this on the big screen. National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
Oh, yeah. Why not?
Sure, why not, yes. And, of course, Friday, December 21st at 7.30 p.m., 35mm print. And the current debate on if it's a Christmas movie or not, it's just a fun movie anyway. The original Die Hard.
Oh, yeah, that's 1988. A Christmas movie. That's one of the top.
It's funny.
It does take place.
It just so happens that it takes place on Christmas. I've always, one of my goals as a director, as a play director, is I want to do It's a Wonderful Life in the non-winter months. Because it is, for me, it's a life-affirming story. Mm-hmm. It's not a Christmas story.
Right.
It, like Die Hard, it just so happens to be set at Christmas.
Yeah.
And you can thank/blame television for slapping it on. By that rationale, that means The Ten Commandments is an Easter movie. And The Wizard of Oz is a Thanksgiving movie. No, that's just kind of where you put it.
Yeah.
So, anyway, that's one of my, if that's that's my version of avant-garde. Over at IU Cinema down in Bloomington, again, if you're listening to this on Saturday, you have a chance at 4 o'clock to see the 1983 drama You Are Not I. And then at 7 o'clock, from 1993, the original Jurassic Park.
Oh.
Not a bad, expensive, science-gone-wrong picture there. Sunday, December 2nd at 1 o'clock, When Pigs Fly. And then Sunday at 4 o'clock, Michael Antonioni's The Passenger.
Oh, yeah.
With Jack Nicholson.
Good film. Yeah.
Monday, December 3rd, the Crimson Film Festival. Oh, that was canceled. Sorry. I have to read ahead, folks. Reading's a skill. Tuesday, December 4th at 7 o'clock, The Exorcist from 1973. Did you see that when it came out?
Oh, yes.
You're doing okay.
I got a little story with that. You
Please.
Want to do that now? Or?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, go
so
for it.
So I was actually working my MFA in, and I had an internship at the Oslo Theater in Sarasota. I was at Florida State and did an internship. And I was staying down there rooming with one of the actors in the company. And I was sleeping on a cot out in the living room. And in Florida, you know, the houses are open underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And just after seeing The Exorcist, and just as I was beginning to fall asleep, two cats underneath the house got into it right below my bed. He had a cat that was under my bed. It jumped and hit my bed. And I pretty much had a heart attack, almost died. That's one of the scariest moments of my life. Couldn't have been timed better.
That's the power of film, ladies and gentlemen, right there. Yeah. My version of that was not The Exorcist, but I was up.
You weren't born yet, right?
Oh, that's very sweet of you to say. I was 3/4 when The Exorcist came out. Math. But I was about 10 or 11, and I was up way too late. I had snuck out of my room, and, you know, you have the warm glow of the screen, and I was watching a Vincent Price film. It was Madhouse. And as I'm watching it, and I'm really into it, and then our cat jumped on my lap. Okay. And then, thing, in a bedroom light's on, here comes Dad.
Yeah.
And ushered back. But it was also one of those things, that's another one of those films that I remember seeing it in college and going, oh, this scared me? the other Exorcist story I have is when, and this is good parenting, I call it pop culture, Atticus Finch. When my daughter Emma was a baby, I was the only one allowed to wipe her face. She didn't like mom doing it, grandma, anybody, because when I wiped her face, I would say, "It burns, it burns," like the demon when hit with holy water. And I did this enough that eventually my daughter started to go, it burns, woo," and my wife. We use a term around the house, sitcom wife look. Yeah. Lynn looks at me and she goes, so when she watches this film in college, and I said, yeah, she's going to know it's from me. But my daughter has seen the film in the daytime. This was a few years ago. And, yeah, that moment happened, and she just kind of gave me a look a lot like her mother's. Yeah. So, yeah. Anyway, The Exorcist on the big screen, 7 o'clock, Tuesday, December 4th. Thursday, December 6th at 7 o'clock. And Alexandre O'Philippe is supposed to be present for the documentary 78/52, Hitchcock's Shower Scene.
Oh.
A documentary about the making of the shower scene. And Alexandre will be at IU speaking at 7 o'clock on Friday, December 7th. Dock of the Dead, his film from 2014, at 10 p.m. And then the 4th annual Sound of Music quote-along print, Saturday, December 8th at 1 o'clock at IU Cinema. So,
not sing-along, quote-along.
Quote-along. So I guess you can talk. This is one year I guess you're allowed to talk during the movie.
Yeah, okay.
So, and then Sunday, December 9th, Mastery Tales at 1 o'clock, the animated short films of Jiří Trnka, hope I'm saying that right. And then at 4 o'clock from 1950, All About Eve.
Oh.
We use a term in our house. When I directed the play Born Yesterday, Emma was probably 11 or 12, and she referred to the genre men in suits talking.
Hmm.
And I assured her that All About Eve is one of the greatest men in suits, women in gowns talking ever made, and she loves it. So anyway, that is at IU Cinema. A couple other titles. I want to catch up on some films that were, honestly, they were sent to me, and so I wanted to bring it up a little bit. But, Jeff Sparks, I would like to know your opinion I didn't tell him this, your opinion of the films of Charles Bronson.
Well, is it Death Wish?
Yes.
Yeah, he did. That was a pretty intense film. But when I think of Charles Bronson, I think of one of my favorite westerns of all time.
Magnificent Seven?
No.
Once Upon a Time in the West?
Yes.
There you go. Yeah.
Which probably has arguably the best opening credits of any movie ever made.
It's so much fun.
It's a story within itself.
Woody Strode, Jack Elam, and the other guy.
Yeah, the other guy.
And of course, the great story behind that, this is the Sergio Leone follow-up. To the good, the bad, and the ugly, it almost felt like a dare. Like you can't make something as big and sweeping and epic as Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And Sergio Leone said, "Watch me."
Yeah.
And of course, the story behind that is it's three guys waiting at a train station for the Charles Bronson character, and Bronson keeps appearing in the film. The others do not.
Yeah,
and the story was originally Leone wanted Lee Van Cleef, Clint Eastwood, and Eli Wallach to be the three, and that didn't happen.
Yeah,
but you got Henry Fonda as a villain.
Oh yeah, you know, the blue eyes of Henry Fonda as he looks out and pulls a gun and shoots a kid in the very beginning of the film. You're like, oh my god.
Yeah, the story on that was When he got cast, he grew a beard out. He put in brown contact lenses.
Oh.
And came on the set, and Leone, who didn't speak much English, went crazy. And he's like, no, I want Henry Fonda, basically. Yeah. So shaved, got the blue eyes. And the opening shot, it's called the Oh My God, It's Henry Fonda shot. Because these guys in long coats that had just gunned down two parents, and there's a kid. And they're walking, and then the camera follows behind them, and then it comes around at his feet, and then goes up and reveals it's Henry Fonda. Yeah. Everybody's all American shooting a 10-year-old boy.
Yeah.
So, well, anyway, I bring this up because I got sent to me from Mill Creek Entertainment a four-film collection of Charles Bronson from the 70s, from the films he did with Columbia. The Valachi Papers, where he is a mobster turned informant, directed by Terrence Young, who did a few of the early Bond films in the 60s. Also did The Stone Killer with Martin Balsam, where he plays a corrupt cop, directed by Michael Winner, if I remember correctly. Breakout, a Tom Grease film where he is a helicopter pilot who is assigned by Jill Ireland. Jill Ireland was his leading lady a lot.
Yeah.
On and off screen, to go rescue her husband from a Mexican prison. The husband is played by Robert Duvall. You have a John Huston cameo. Mm-hmm. It's actually a lighter film than
I
were
you. I remember that film, but it's been a long
time. Yeah, it's a. Randy Quaid is in it, and Sherry North, and it's a slightly lighter, almost. And there's some comedic moments by Bronson, which is nice to have because by the second half of his career, he was getting a lot of money to play a blank slate.
Yeah.
And so anyways, to see some little flash of of something was fun. And then Hard Times, the directorial debut of Walter Hill, and it's him, is Bronson and James Coburn. And Bronson plays a bare-knuckle brawler in Prohibition-era New Orleans.
Oh.
And James Coburn plays his manager. And it's great footage of 70s New Orleans, which, of course, looks like 1870s New Orleans. And, you know, you could say any of the buddy films of sport, this is one of those.
Yeah.
So, but the thing about Bronson I always remember is if you look at his 70s outlook, and of course Death Wish is the pinnacle, his 70s output is pretty good. I think it is, like the Death Wish series, it is overshadowed by the 80s and the 90s of his films, Death Wish 5. And, you know, he wound up doing a lot of films for Canon that were low budget except for his paycheck.
Right.
So he kind of got paid a lot to be tough guy Charles Bronson, some of which fairly sleepy. But, yeah, so, but anyway, but, yeah, so see him go from those two Westerns we mentioned in the 60s and then doing Death Wish and then trying to do different things like Breakheart Pass and The White Buffalo and Hard Times and even Breakout. So anyway, this was a pretty good collection to watch. Also out that was sent to me. I'm still plowing through this. It's a chore, and this is first world problems. But Time Life Home Video has put out a 22 disc set of Robin Williams, and it's basically everything Robin Williams ever did that wasn't a movie. I think on previous shows I talked about all of his HBO specials and the follow-ups and turnabouts with that. Every time he was on Leno, the extended version of Inside the Actor's Studio, and it's fascinating to watch. And the documentary that HBO did on him earlier this year, And so it's just a reminder of the challenge. Is capturing all of that energy on film. And, you know, early on, it wasn't until Good Morning Vietnam that they were able to find the right tone of, okay, you have to act in this scene, use your Juilliard training, and then we're just going to let the camera roll with you in front of a microphone like a Good Morning Vietnam and just go with it.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm still going through this, but it's still fascinating to watch.
Yeah.
So, I also got this sent to me, and I wound up talking about this online. With I got a couple of concert films, concert Blu-rays, and it made me. One is Melanie Live at the Meltdown Festival 2007. If you remember Melanie, Brand New Key, Rain Down, and then also received Yes, Yes's Yes Song's 40th anniversary. Both of these were from MVD Visual. So I put out on my Facebook page, best use of music by Melanie and Yes in a film.
Hmm.
And the two that I was able to come up with, Heart of the Sunrise, for Yes, Heart of the Sunrise, that's used in the film and in the trailer for Buffalo 66,
okay,
the Vincent Gallo, yep, film. And for Melanie, the use of Brand New Key in Boogie Nights.
Oh.
Where there's an intimate scene with Mark Wahlberg and Heather Graham. And we'll leave it at that. And I had a few people chime in. Eric from Indianapolis said they also use Brand New Key in Jackass 3D.
Oh.
Of course they
did.
Of
course. I recall that.
it's a routine called the Bungie Boogie.
Bungie Boogie.
So it's a, okay, guys are on roller skates. That's why the song. And then a bungee cord, and they shoot them up like a... Mrs. Sosi would say, made by boys for boys.
Yes.
No, that doesn't count. Yeah, so anyway, there was a couple of those out there. That's funny. But it was fun watching Melanie and also, and yeah, so I appreciate that. The other concert film I received recently, and this came 2 weeks before his death, but the concert film... Glastonbury Fair, and this was a festival that happened in Glastonbury, England, 1971, and it featured the likes of Melanie, Traffic was the big headliner, Arthur Brown, Terry Reid, but this was shot by Nicholas Roeg, who we'll get to in a little bit. But this was a even though there was all the mud and rain in Woodstock, this was a more down-to-earth festival. It didn't feel like a commercial event. And they built a stage that looked like a giant pyramid. So we'll get to that in a little bit. And then finally, sent to me by Shout Factory, Jeffrey, did you ever see the 1987 film version of Dragnet?
Yes.
What do you remember of it?
Nothing.
There you go. Dan Aykroyd is, I believe, the nephew of Joe Friday and a pre-big Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks was still in his bachelor party, yeah, smart aleck phase of his career as his young hip partner. And I was 17 when this film came, mm-hmm, out, so I was the perfect demographic for it. And watching it with my daughter, either, who knew nothing about Dragnet.
Right.
There were times where it wanted to be a buddy cop film, like every other action film from the 80s, and it almost wanted to be an Airplane-like parody of the TV series. Yeah. And it was just it's an odd mix.
Yeah.
It's an odd mix. So anyway, those are out there. Thank you for sending me those. We'll keep at it. All right. Shifting gears. Yes. Jeff Sparks is here with me. He's written a book called Changing Culture Through Stories. And it talks about the building of the New Harmony Project and the Heartland Film Festival. So I want to start, Jeff, with what plays and films affected you as a young lad?
Oh, young?
Yeah.
Well, I remember when movies were a special event. The one that comes to mind was I was probably 13, 14 maybe, when Sound of Music came out.
Ah.
And it played at the Lowe's Theater at that time for a long time. And it sat.
Yeah, I remember those days.
Huge theater. And go, you dressed up, you went to...
It's like traveling.
Yeah, it was an event. And I remember listening to the music before going, getting so excited about seeing it. And then the spectacular film, what Robert Wise did with that film was... brilliant. They chose him because they didn't want it to be a real Pollyanna kind of... They wanted it to have a bit of an edge. And that's why Robert Wise was selected to direct Sound of Music.
And this was his musical follow-up to West Side Story.
Yeah.
So that's
not a bad
back-to-back musical.
Right. That film had a tremendous impact on me. And another Robert Wise film that I didn't realize until we honored him in 1992, and I was going through his film reel that he had sent, and it just showed all the films that he had directed. And he directed a film called The Haunting.
Oh, yes. The original Haunting.
Yes. And I called him. I said, Bob, I watched that. I was probably 12 or 13 years old, and it scared the bejabers out of me. And he said, I know, Jeff, that I've had so many people tell me. And then that following Halloween, I remember USA Today on their movie, they were talking about all the horror films that were coming out, but they said, skip all those and see the best. And it was The Haunting. It was the film that which is just an amazing film, still holds up, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, I will use the term, I think it's a grown-up scary film.
Yeah.
And it's
because you never really see
what
this horrible thing that is out there is.
It's amazing what atmosphere and mood and then a little directing and editing will do for a picture like that.
But I grew up loving movies. And again, movies were something very special. We didn't have videos. You could see some on TV, but, you know, they were interrupted by commercials. And so to go to the theater, and my dad was a factory worker. We didn't go to movies a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I remember seeing Thunder Road at the drive-in Claremont drive-in theater.
Robert Mitchum?
Yeah.
Wow.
There
you go.
These are films that when you... Okay, what do you remember? Those are films I just, for some reason, always stick with me. You know, Old Yeller, when I was a kid, just tears your heart out. Still does, I think, today. It's a bit dated. But
you know, shooting dogs getting shot are sadly timeless.
Yeah.
So.
So those are some that come to mind. I know there are probably many more.
Okay.
But, yeah, they're movies... I think in all of our lives play a very important role. And, you know, that's why, because of movies' impact, you know, that's why we started the New Harmony Project and Heartland Film Festival.
I was going to say, one of the things that you talk about the power of stories. I mean, human beings are storytellers.
Right.
And like any other thing, some people are better at it than others,
mm-hmm.
and everybody has a different style and approach.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that you helped get off the ground two different forms of storytelling
mm-hmm.
is phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a true gift. The journey was amazing. It all started, I was running a children's home, a treatment center for emotionally disturbed kids, had a lot of court referrals, many from Indianapolis. Judge Jim Payne back in the day used us quite a bit. And it's like I had a microscope on the problem, because these kids coming from very tough situations would come in wearing death tattooed all over them, listening to death, waiting for the next slasher mm-hmm. film to come out. And I just started talking to my friends going, where is our culture? Where are adults making really good movies, entertaining movies that have something to say at that moment for our kids?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's just, where are they? So we started talking and ended up coming together. There were 12 of us in April of 86. And we gathered on the northwest side at the Embassy Suites for a long weekend. And out of that really hardworking 2.5 days, we came up with two ideas. And one was to do a writer's laboratory and find writers who had that affirming voice,
mm-hmm.
not to train writers, but to find those writers, bring them together, give them resources, actors, directors, dramaturgs, story editors, whatever they needed, let them live in community for 2 weeks and work on their play or their film. And the second idea was a film festival.
Going back to New Harmony, how did New Harmony get selected as the location?
Well, I went to University of Evansville.
Ah.
And four others in that 12-person group, we had all done summer theater in New Harmony. And we all agreed. What an idyllic place. If you've not been to New Harmony, mm-hmm. you're missing one of the true gems of this country. It's not real easy to get to. It's on the Wabash, 15 miles north of the Ohio. It's an incredible little town that has an amazing history. The only place where two utopian experiments were tried. And we just said it's got a theater. It actually had two theaters. It's a great place to do this. So that's how New Harmony was selected. And we thought, Mrs. Owen will probably like this, and she has a foundation. And mm-hmm. So we embarked on, and within a year, so that was April of 86, in May of 87, we had our first project.
Okay, pause for a second.
Yes.
What plays did you do at U of E?
Oh, I did a lot. okay. I have to.
Welcome the Gotcha Journalism. Welcome the Gotcha Journalism.
Yeah. I directed. That's where I found out I really wanted to be a director.
Okay.
I directed one act by Pinter, Harold Pinter. I grew to really love Pinter's work, and mm-hmm. I did a lot of his pieces through my short directing career. But then I went on, was selected. That was my junior year. Selected to direct the children's play the following year, my senior year. And my friend, roommate, David McFadden, wrote a play. And I helped write the music for it. And we put on a play, and I'll think of the name in a second. But that was fun.
Okay.
And so I thought, maybe I could be a director. So I chose to direct Waiting for Godot.
Whoa.
I thought, if I can do this, I can probably do about anything. And it was a very successful production of Waiting for Godot.
Excellent.
Which
it's one a hard play to do.
Very hard. One of the things I did, and somewhat controversial, but I had help from our English professors. I did the first act without cutting anything. But I took the second act and basically cut about half of it out.
Mm.
So, because it can be a 3-hour play.
Correct.
And it's just too long for a lot of American audiences.
Right.
And I think it worked very well. So you got what Bertolt Brecht was trying to do in the first act. And in the second act, you got his message, but you didn't have to sit through it again. It was very successful, so I went on to get my MFA at University of Florida State University in directing. And there, I started the Playwrights Theater of Florida State.
Okay.
Because I looked around and I thought, why aren't the MFA directors directing the MFA playwrights' plays?
Mm-hmm.
No one had thought of that. We went to the administration. They went, great idea. We don't have any space for it. Good luck with that. So we found a church that let us have their basement. And we started the Playwrights Theater of Florida State that went on for several years after I left.
Very good.
So that got me into working with writers at a very young age. A lot of folks don't get that chance in school. And I fell in love with the process.
One other University of Evansville note, its current famous alum is Rami Malek.
Yes.
So yeah. kudos.
Yeah.
I'm sure the Alumni Association has already called him.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. All right. I met him on a couple of occasions.
You?
Very quirky guy. Yeah,
cool.
Very interesting guy.
It's been a good
when
year
he
for
was
him.
A student.
Yeah. So, okay. So when New Harmony first started, how many writers had scripts?
We did workshopped? Four. We did four pieces that first year, there were, I almost have to. Do you have the book? Yeah.
Yeah, I do.
Let me. Can you?
Yeah, hold on.
That'll help me. One of them was interestingly David McFadden's play, who I was the guy first directed, we had. I'm going to just look.
That's
here.
Fine. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show.
Yeah,
here.
You Jeff can edit Spartan. This out.
No, I tend to keep. I've done hot keyboard searching action on the program. But the other thing about the book, as you're sifting through it, is both festivals/projects has a year-by-year record, which is really cool, especially those who those who have been to the festival year after year. You can I remember this, I remember that. So it was nice.
Well, interesting on writing the book. I'm not a writer. You know, I tell people I have two answers if somebody asks me, have you read? It's either, is it a movie yet? Or, to quote Jonathan Winters, saw the movie, missed the book.
Mm-hmm.
That was when he was asked about Moby Dick.
Yes.
So we did four plays. Johnny Pie and the Fool Killer was a musical with Randy Quartz and Mark St. Germain, and it was just a wonderful writing duo that did several pieces. Oklahoma Rigs was the one that Dave McFadden did. Porch, which was the screenplay adaptation of a very popular play by Jeffrey Arch, and then St. Hugo of Central Park, Jeff Kinley. The one that went on, Johnny Pie and the Fool Killer actually had a life and had some off-Broadway productions and it was done regionally a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on a short story by, and I'm just
that writer.
That writer, a very famous writer. I'll think of that. But so in the second year, we almost didn't get it pulled off because we lost some funding and weren't sure we were going to be able to do it. But we pulled it together. We shortened it. It was one of the shortest. We didn't do a full 2 weeks, but we did it. And from that point on, New Harmony Project is still going and very strong now.
Yes.
So, and it's an exciting time to go to New Harmony. It's all the final weekend is always the weekend after Memorial Day.
Right.
So we take the 2 weeks, the week before and the week after Memorial Day is when all the writers and actors are in. And that last weekend, there's one event. It's a little bit of a fundraiser, but you can see readings throughout the weekend that are free. It's an incredible time to take in New Harmony, but also have that opportunity to see readings of and Pulitzer Prize-winning writers, Academy Award-winning writers have been at New Harmony.
Yep.
There's some amazing pieces that have come out of New Harmony.
And you've also had some heavy hitters at the Heartland Film Festival.
Oh, yeah.
And if I remember right from reading it, wasn't one of your first early coups getting the attention of Carl Malden?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's the opening of the book. Ken Wales, a good friend, a Hoosier, had a lot of good connections. Ken produced some of the Pink Panther films, was very close with Brooke, the director of Pink Panther.
Blake Edwards. Right.
I had Brooke in my mind.
That's okay.
Blake Edwards, in fact, introduced Blake to Julie Andrews.
Oh.
He had worked with Julie on Hawaii.
Okay.
And anyway, he was best man in their wedding. Ken introduced us to three key people, Robert Wise, Carl Malden, and Charles Champlin. Not as well known here, but the film critic for the L.A. Times in the 60s and 70s became the arts editor of the calendar, came up with the calendar that became one of the rags, the movie rags in L.A., Charles, not a Hoosier. He was one of the three that wasn't a Hoosier, but he loved the idea. But my first meeting with Carl, he was president of the Motion Picture Academy.
That's right.
And, I'll never forget walking in for the first time to the Academy, going up to the president's office and meeting with the Carl Malden. And today he's not as well known, but boy,
we'll sit on the front porch and tell people who he was.
But at the time, he was still acting and was again president of the Motion Picture Academy.
That's right.
And it was an amazing time. And he became, along with Bob and Charles, not just figurehead; they were honorary board members, but they helped all through, especially at the beginning, introducing us to folks. So a true gift to have those three wonderful men helping launch Heartland Film Festival.
And so you have, of course, screenings, but you also have panel discussions and social events and,
right.
A great opportunity to showcase young filmmakers, obscure filmmakers, filmmakers with a story to, a heart-filled story to tell.
Yeah, and I think this last year were over 150 filmmakers from all over the world at Heartland. So it's a chance not only to see great films that you may not otherwise see, but to meet the filmmaker, Q&A after a lot of the screenings. People hang out in the hall, go over to the tent, and just talk to filmmakers. It's an amazing opportunity if you really want to know more about filmmaking.
I got to ask Carl Malden a question when you guys, there was the screening of On the Waterfront on the big screen, and it was the he basically told me bad guys don't think they're bad guys. They don't wake up, twirl their mustache, and you know. And I brought up his role in The Cincinnati Kid.
Oh yeah,
and so that was for a young impressionable knucklehead. And then the funny story of him playing Omar Bradley in Patton.
Yes.
And George C. Scott, who plays Patton, had disobeyed Bradley's order, and there was a discussion about, well, you know, should he be chewing him out like every other cop film where you see the lieutenant screaming at the cop, and it was finally agreed, no, Omar Bradley didn't have to raise his voice. Why not? And he points to his helmet, because I got one more star on my helmet than he does, and it's just fun stories on that.
Yeah.
When did Hollywood, with a capital H, when did they really kind of turn their heads toward Indianapolis with the festival?
Yeah, I think it was a very slow turn. It wasn't anything sudden. I think we captured the attention of Dick Cook our very first year. Dick, at the time, was the head of distribution for Disney. He then went on to become chairman of Disney and Studios, and he helped immensely to help turn heads, because they, every step of Heartland, and it is throughout the book, you know, okay, here we go, Dick Cook is back helping us again. They were the first to use the Truly Moving Picture Award on their advertising of Remember the Titans. They gave us the premiere of the re-release of Snow White our very first year, which was huge. I remember Bonnie Britton, who was writing for the Star at the time, had the front page of the Life section all ready with all the it was the Sunday before, and we sold out right when that was coming out. She was very upset. She's like, I'm promoting this and you don't have any tickets. So I called Dick and I said, Dick, is there any way we could get a second screening? And he went back, sure, do it, show it again. And we were at the Circle Theater, and within 48 hours, we sold the second screening out of an amazing presentation, because people don't realize there were no videos back then.
Right.
Well, there were videos, but there weren't Disney videos.
Yeah.
They put them in the vault.
Every 7 years.
Every seven years. Yep. So there were a lot of people who had not seen Snow White, in little kids who had never seen it, only pictures. So it was an amazing kickoff for Heartland.
What has become fun now is to look for the logo, is to look for the Truly Moving Pictures.
Yeah.
And because for us, it's like, that's us. That's Indiana right there. So, numerous films. And the festival always has a link with me for a couple reasons. One, I got married the weekend of the festival in 1999. I got married on, Lynn and I got married on a Friday. And then Saturday, we saw Walking Across Egypt.
Yes.
With Ellen Burstyn.
Ellen Burstyn, and Judge Reinhold.
That's right. So, because we had lunch. We had a really long lunch and watched college football on Saturday with all the people that drove in. And then, we kind of gave the option, like, you want to go to Heartland? Here we go. So there was that.
Wow, didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So,
or I probably knew it and have forgotten.
And no, it's
that's
okay.
That's great.
But fortunately, it is. And ladies and gentlemen, it has not been when I find out Heartland is coming up. I don't. My anniversary too. So I know when my anniversary is.
That's good.
But the other one, and as I said, you go through the book, and it's fun when you see a film that is in the festival, and then you see it on TV or on video. Like, yes. I remember something as frothy and lightweight as Wish Upon a Star,
yeah.
a kind of freaky
yeah.
Friday story with a yeah. very young Katherine Heigl. And then it, I saw it in the video store. I went, hey, there it is.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's a sweet little film.
It is.
Yeah.
So just when the... Because, yeah, when you go to festivals, sometimes a film plays at a festival, and then... It disappears.
Yeah.
So the
yeah.
fact, and of course, now that we can watch movies on our phones and computers, and
yeah.
but the fact is, these films have a chance to be seen again.
Yeah.
And the other one, and this is one of my, and I give you all the credit in the world for this, you introduced me to Horton Foote.
Mm-hmm.
And Horton Foote is the only celebrity I ever got tongue tied
mm-hmm.
talking to.
And. Ironically, most people probably don't know who Horton
and
is.
And that's really on them.
Yeah.
So you should read Trip to Bountiful and Tender Mercies. For me, I was 13 when Tender Mercies came out, and it blew me away.
Mm.
It was my first – that and the Bill Forsythe film Local Hero were my introductions to the concept of less is more.
Mm.
And,
oh, yeah. Horton was the master of less – is more.
What is said, what is not said, is yes. just as powerful as what is being said. And as a 13-year-old boy in the 80s, I really needed that.
Mm.
And then 2 years later was the film version of Bountiful, and that was really kind of my introduction to Geraldine Page. I knew she was the lady in The Beguiled,
yeah.
and then there was that, and that was amazing. And then...
Which she won
the Academy Award.
Posthumously.
No, she was still alive.
Was she still
she
alive?
Was, yeah.
Oh.
Because F. Murray Abraham referred to her as the greatest actress in the history of the English language. And that kind of took my,
whoa.
Like, wow, high praise.
Yeah.
And then, like a year later, in my high school English class, we watched Mockingbird. And I didn't know he did the adaptation.
Yeah.
And I said, holy bleep, it's the Tender Mercies Bountiful guy. And my English teacher kind of came over, what did you say? And then I explained, I said, sorry for my outburst. And I explained, and he goes, okay. All right, so cursed, but I didn't get in trouble. But
I won the Academy Award for the adaptation
and the original screenplay for Mercy. So anyway, he was here for Alone, a film he did with Hume Cronin, Chris Cooper, Shelley Duvall, and you'd asked me, would you like to meet him? And I was and if you know me, folks, I can throw a line. I can have a schmooze and a drink and everything. And here's this little man in a little tan suit.
Yeah, he looks like Clarence in It's a Wonderful
Life.
Yeah.
And you introduce me, and I shake his hand, and the only thing that comes out of my mouth is, I love your work. And and he was very nice. And then that was it. But there was, the business part of me just went, way to go, Slick. But the other part of me was like, no, he means that much.
Yeah. People who knew him were dedicated to him. Actors like Robert Duvall would do anything for Horton. Matthew Broderick.
Yep. He's in the film version of 1918, among others.
Yeah. The love that people have, Gary Sinise.
Yep.
Great story on Gary. When we tributed Horton, Gary was coming down from Chicago to be a part of the tribute. And there was a snowstorm. Mm-hmm. And I get a call, and I'll never forget because he always did this. I get this call. He said, Jeff, this is Gary Sinise. There was always a pause. This is Gary Sinise. He said, they're going to cancel my flight, and I can't miss this.
Mm-hmm.
I have got to get there. So we got a limousine to drive him down from Chicago in a snowstorm. He got here in time.
I say, that's a three-hour drive normally. Well,
yeah.
How long did it take?
It was about 6 hours.
Uh-huh.
But he got here in plenty of time.
Okay.
He said, I slept in the back of the limousine. And he was there for Horton. I mean, that's the kind of dedication that people had to Horton. And I was just honored to get to know him.
Yeah.
I actually spent time with him in Wharton, Texas, which is where he grew up, in his home where he was born. Just to be in that town, which informs about everything he writes, was just an incredible experience. And he was a most gracious guy. I remember when I was there, he said, now, Jeffrey, I have to take a phone call. He said, the LA Times wants to interview me. about The Apostle, which had not come out yet.
Correct.
And there was a lot of rumor that Horton had ghost-written The Apostle.
Oh, yeah.
And he was making it very clear that he did not write it, that Duvall had asked him to write it,
mm-hmm.
and he told Robert, he said, no, I'll help you, I'll read your drafts, but you're going to write it because you're the one who experienced it.
And it's funny you mention that because it does have a Foot-esque feel about it.
Yeah. So, but he was interviewing, the movie had just come out, and he was talking to the LA Times about, you know, his role. Another amazing film, in my opinion. I remember with Duvall, go ahead, yes.
No, we got about 5 minutes.
5 minutes. He had just seen The Apostle. We screened it here. It had already come out. Mm. We did that two or three times. It was opening night, and he had just come from Paris where he had seen it screened. And we were walking over, and I said, you know, I can't wait to see this on the IMAX screen. You know, just with the sound. Is so. He said, well, Jeff, I just saw it in Paris. I have to say it was pretty. They do serious screening. They take their screenings very serious in Paris. Basically won't match. When it was over, we walked out, and I said, well, what'd you think? He said, better than Paris.
I got to direct The Trip to Bountiful twice.
Yeah.
I was honored to be able to do that with the same two ladies who played Mrs. Watts and Jessie May.
Yeah.
And then a month after, the second time, Cincinnati Playhouse did it. And this was an African-American production.
Mm.
There was a revival with Cicely Tyson.
Oh,
well-deserved, wonderful. And there's a wonderful film version of that. And I met the director, and we were kind of exchanging our own experiences, and he summed it up best. He goes, this is a career New York guy, and he said, this is just one script you don't bleep with.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, that sums it up best.
Yeah.
So, Jeff,
pushed
the book again.
Yeah. It's very easy to get.
Good.
Heartlandbook.org.
There you go.
And it takes you right to the page. You can order it. You can get it at heartlandbook.org. The words folks are sharing with me have been quite wonderful. It's, I think, an easy read. It's a fun read. And it has something to say. Even if you don't know anything about Heartland or New Harmony, the goal of this is just to look at the power of story and stories about these two organizations that I think, and a lot of people seem to agree, that Heartland and New Harmony have had an impact on culture.
Excellent. Thank you, Jeff. We have a couple minutes. I do want to get to Dead People We Like, because we never have time for Dead People We Don't Like.
Yeah.
Filmmaker Bernardo Bertolucci, best known for The Conformist, the controversial Last Tango in Paris, and that's still in there. 1900, Luna, of course, won the Academy Award for The Last Emperor, Little Buddha, Stealing Beauty, Estranged, The Dreamers.
Oh, yeah.
Salute to that. Nicholas Rogue, who was a cinematographer and director of photography. He worked on Fahrenheit 451, Petula, and then later directed Walkabout, Performance, Don't Look Now, Glastonbury Fair, Bad Timing, The Man Who Fell to Earth, Eureka. Also want to mention Gloria Katz, who was one of the screenwriters on American Graffiti.
Mm-hmm.
Also wrote Lucky Lady, More American Graffiti, French Postcards, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Best Defense, and Howard the Duck, Nobody's Perfect, and Radioland Murders. And then finally, Ricky Jay. Ricky Jay, who was the magician and wound up being one of David Mamet's regular players in films like House of Games, Things Change, Homicide, Spanish Prisoner. He was in Boogie Nights, Tomorrow Never Dies, Mystery Men, State and Main, Heist, The Prestige, of course, Red Belt, and many others. So so salute to all of them for their fine work. And now we'll have to revisit some of those films. But ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Jeff, thank you for hanging out today.
Yeah, it's been fun.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!